All right. I appreciate everyone tolerating me now twice today. As I kind of mentioned before, I'm still getting over this cold, so I'm sorry if I end up hacking and everything. But, yeah. Also, I suppose now is as good a time as any to just outright state this. I talk a lot longer than my dad, so don't expect to get out at 12:45. So, sorry. But this afternoon, we're going to continue our journey in Mark. If you want to be opening up there, we're going to be picking up where Dad left off at the feeding of the 5,000. And we're going to be talking about, as you can see, Jesus walking on the water. So if you want to go ahead and turn over to Mark chapter 6, verse 45, while you're turning over there, I want to kind of mention something, and I implore you to keep it in the back of your mind as much as possible throughout this lesson. Like I said, we're going to be looking at Jesus walking on the water. And this event follows the feeding of the 5,000 just right after it, right as Mark says, as you'll see immediately. These two events are explicitly intertwined. They cannot be separated. You cannot take Christ walking on the water and separate it from Jesus feeding the 5,000. In all the Gospels that the walking on water is mentioned, which is three of them minus Luke. Luke is the only one that doesn't mention it. In every single one of those Gospels, walking on water is right after the feeding of the 5,000. It is clearly intentional by the Spirit that these two events are right next to each other. It's like that in all three Gospels that it's in. So, they go together, and we're going to reference back to the feeding quite a bit. Now, even beyond that, I'm actually convinced that what happens with Jesus walking on the water, I'm convinced that this whole event actually happens because of what happened at the feeding of the 5,000. You're going to see what I mean as we go along. But to understand what I'm getting at, we kind of have to look at what's going on during those two events. So, you know, the feeding was what could be probably considered as Jesus' high point in his public ministry, right? There was, as we estimated, probably around 20,000 people plus there, something to that effect. There could have easily been more. If you read John's account of what happened over there, you actually see that they were trying to throng him and the disciples and take Jesus and make him king. Jesus was wildly popular at this point. At this point, Jesus has not kind of stopped doing miracles and whatnot. The public, they're obsessed with him. They were obsessed with the Messiah. They were obsessed with Jesus. But the problem was, this was the earthly view of the Messiah, right? They wanted to take him and make him a political ruler. They wanted to kind of like set Jesus up to stampede Rome, right? This was the earthly view of the Messiah. And they really had no concern for the spiritual truth that Jesus was preaching. All they really cared about was, you know, this is finally the end of Rome. Israel's going to be restored to glory. That's what they wanted the Messiah for. So, because of this, John tells us, Jesus sent the multitude away. He says, no, I'm not here to set up your welfare state. I'm not here to feed you breakfast. He sends the multitude away. He feeds them, and then he sends them away. But how does this connect to the walking on water? Like, why am I talking about this? Well, look at verse 52 in Mark. Now it says, "For they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened." Now the NASB makes this a little bit more clear. Modern translations translate it like this. It says, "They had not gained any insight from the feeding of the 5,000 or the loaves, for their heart was hardened." They had not gained any insight. What you have to understand about this event in the Gospels is that right now, the disciples have not figured out who Jesus is exactly. They have the same belief as everyone else. They think he's the Messiah. They know that, you know, in the very beginning of John, they're excited. Andrew goes and gets Peter and he says, "Hey, I found the Messiah." They know he's the Messiah, but they don't know that he's more than that. They don't know that he's God. They had the same belief as everyone else. They believed that Jesus was going to restore Israel, stampede Rome. They knew Jesus was a man from God. They knew he was the Messiah. They'd even seen that he had control over demons, life and death, nature, authority. They saw that he had authority to teach the law like no one else. They saw that. But what they hadn't put together was the very purpose of Mark's gospel, and it was that Jesus was the Son of God. They hadn't figured that out yet. So, being honest, I mean, if we're going to be bluntly honest, and this isn't really all that condescending because we're often like this, but the disciples were being spiritual blockheads. They were being blockheads. Jesus had literally given them power to cast out demons and perform miracles, and they still hadn't figured it out yet. They had not gained any insight. They were getting there. They were getting there. But their hearts were still hardened to the truth. That Greek phrase, when it says their hearts were hardened, that conveys more than just ignorance or kind of just not knowing. That conveys active rebellion and disobedience. Their hearts were hardened on a deeper level than just not understanding. It was an active not believing. But, you know, if you read back in verses 37 through 44 and you read the other gospel accounts, you really can see that the disciples during the feeding, they're a bit hangry. They're a little bit hangry. They want to send the people away. They really don't seem to be too thrilled about Jesus saying, "No, you feed them." They're kind of like, "Oh, okay." And they're certainly having issues believing that it could be done in the first place, which is really kind of a concerning thought because a lot's riding on these 12, or 11 really, because Judas was, as we know, a traitor. But, you know, after Christ leaves, lots riding on these 12 or 11, and even after everything they had seen up till this point, they didn't understand that for Jesus, creating biscuits was about as hard as going with his hands, you know. So the question is, when did they get it? At some point, they had to understand it, right? As we know, a lot was riding on these 11. They had to understand at some point that Jesus was God. So they were going to have to understand that. And, you know, he's more than just a man. They were going to have to understand that he was more than just a man from God. He was God himself. So whether it was Satan or their flesh or whatever it was, something wasn't clicking in their minds at this point. At the feeding of the 5,000, something was not clicking. They were not understanding. But Jesus wasn't going to let that stop him. And he had to make them understand somehow. Somehow these disciples are going to have to come to that knowledge. Sorry. So we come to our text today. And this is the night that Jesus not just displays his divinity. This is the night that Jesus thrusts it in the disciples' faces. This is the night that they understand that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, you might be wondering, you might be staring at verse 52 where it says, you know, well, all it says is they didn't consider the miracle. They didn't gain any insight. Well, I'm going to show you as we go along. Just hold on. I'll show you as we go along. It's going to be a good passage today. I'm excited about this. It shows Jesus' deity so clearly, and it's a wonderful passage. There's a lot of spiritual truth in it. We're going to see a lot of good evidence here. We're going to see how far Jesus is going to go to protect the ones that he loves and cares about. We're going to see his deity. We're also going to see some things about human nature. We're going to see things about how quickly we are to lose faith. And we're also going to see how the Son of God can overcome that and even make the most spiritually dumb and blind see. There's a lot to unpack. So let's get started in verse 45. It says, "And straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people." Now, quite in style with Mark's usual writing, he writes that this took place immediately after the feeding. But this isn't just Mark being, he's not just being speedy while he's writing. This actually took place right after the feeding. This was about the same day. It was just a little bit later in the day. So this certainly was immediate. Now, that word constrained, it comes from a Greek word that means to force or strongly urge. The word kind of suggests that the disciples didn't have much of a choice in the matter. It seems that for whatever reason, Jesus was essentially forcing them to go into the boat and leave. Our English word constrain means to compel or force someone to follow a particular course or action. So Jesus compelled the disciples to get into the boat, and it seems that this boat is just one that they have kind of took for themselves. I'm not sure how they got it exactly. It's not really mentioned, but this boat, it's their boat, and they get in, they leave. And I always tend to think about the cynic as I'm, or the skeptic as I'm doing lessons, and something that MacArthur noted in his sermon on this passage was, John says that Jesus told them to go to Capernaum instead of Bethsaida, and of course, you know, people love to try and find every little contradiction they can find in the Gospels, but before you do that, let me explain the location really quick. Jesus and his disciples are currently on the northeastern side of the Sea of Galilee. It's offshore a little bit, but that's where they are. So, they're a couple miles from Bethsaida. We learned that last week. And Bethsaida is a little bit to the west, okay? Bethsaida is to the west. But what's also to the west is Capernaum. So, what seems to be Jesus' intention here is to ultimately land in Capernaum, but to make pit stops at Bethsaida along the way, and also, as we see, Gennesaret on the way, because it's all to the west. So there's really no contradiction here. What it is Jesus is just simply giving a blueprint of their journey, kind of what they're going to do. So I just like to mention that, just for the cynic or the skeptic that looks at it. I like to mention those things. But anyway, back to the Jesus and the disciples. He sends them away. He sends them away. And then he dismisses the crowd, which, by the way, is no small feat. Getting 100 people to listen to you is hard enough. Imagine 20,000 plus people. He gets them to leave, perhaps by divine authority, perhaps by some other means. He gets them to leave. So the multitude goes away, and then we see verse 46, and it says, "And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray." Now, it's not uncommon in the Gospels to find Jesus doing this. He prays often, and he talks to the Father all the time. We see this throughout the Gospels. It's a regular thing. He goes to isolated places, and he kneels, and he talks to the Father. Now, we see Jesus do this here. We see him do this here. And the multitude has been sent away. The disciples are headed west. So Jesus takes some time alone, and he goes up to the mountain to pray. Interestingly, though, you know, we read often that Jesus prayed, but we're rarely told what Jesus actually says. You know, the only prayers really recorded of Jesus besides him sometimes verbally thanking the Father, like in one such instance when he says, "I thank you for covering their eyes," whatnot. We have Jesus' prayer before his crucifixion in the garden when he prays to the Father. And then we have him praying in the upper room for himself, the disciples, and all believers. Other than that, we don't really have a whole lot of what Jesus says in his prayers. Now, this sermon is not about those prayers, although those subjects are wonderful things and you should look at them. But, again, I bring all this up to say, we're told Jesus went to pray, but we're not told what he actually said. Now, I would say it's a little bit up for debate as to what Jesus said, but, you know, anything concluded about what he said would have to be admitted as speculation. We'd have to say that it's just speculation. But MacArthur kind of posits that he thinks that he was praying for the disciples. And I'd say there might be a good chance that he's doing that, because he's done it before. He's prayed for them. And this whole passage, I mean, this whole passage is about Jesus, certainly. It's about him and his deity. But this passage pretty much is about him and his disciples. The multitude is gone, and it's just going to be him and the disciples. So I have a feeling that Jesus probably did pray for his disciples when he went up to the mountain. Now, you know, he probably did ask the Father to open their eyes and things like that. And we could probably almost see this as sort of a interceding type prayer, kind of, if that's what he was praying about. But either way, Jesus is alone here. and he's on the mountain. He's praying to the Father. And then we have this next verse, and I want to read part of verse 48. So, we see, "And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw them toiling and rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them." Let's stop there. So, what's happening here is that the boat's not supposed to be in the middle of... When it says the midst of the sea, it means the boat's in the middle of the sea, alright? Now, the English here kind of downplays the severity of this. When it says the wind was contrary to them, according to John, they were about 4 miles off course. So, they had intended to stay along the shoreline and head to Bethsaida, and they had been drug out to the middle of the Sea of Galilee. And, you know, the wind had blown them all off course. And if you know anything about the Sea of Galilee, it's a little bit on the treacherous side sometimes when it gets stormy over there. So, you know, in a moment, you'll see that Jesus came to them in the fourth watch of the night. That means 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. So it's estimated that they've been rowing up to maybe 8 or 9 hours now, and they're stuck in the middle of the sea. So they're tired. They're fatigued. They probably think they're going to die, just like the last time they were in a storm in the middle of the sea. And the audacity of Jesus, right? He told them to get into the boat and go over to Bethsaida, and now they're stuck in the middle of the sea, right? But look closer here. Did you notice that the same Jesus who told them to get in the boat and go was still on the land but could still somehow see them? You know, maybe Mark forgot to mention that Jesus made it down to shore, and no, that's not what's happening. They're about 4 miles offshore, and your eyes don't work that well even in the daytime. It's storming. It's nighttime. Jesus is alone on the land, and it can only mean one thing. The Jesus that commanded them to go is omniscient and can see them right now. He's alone on the land. They're out in the middle of the sea. He sees them miraculously, and he certainly knew before this even happened that the storm was going to come to pass. And in fact, actually, I think there's a good chance he prayed for it. I bet there's a good chance he did pray for the storm. But isn't it just ridiculous? I mean, the disciples technically are obeying. They're not disobeying Jesus. They're in the middle of the sea. They got in the boat and went. So what gives? Why is this happening? Why does Jesus let this happen? Does he not care that they're going to die out there? Well, it's actually kind of interesting because almost verbatim, this is what happened with the last incident. There was a storm. And, you know, some have suggested that the disciples should have had the faith and the power to calm the sea themselves. And that might be true. If they did, though, they obviously didn't have enough faith. And we don't see that anywhere else in Scripture. But regardless, you know, Jesus is going to put them to the test in a different way. And he's going to show them something. And I think it's really interesting. And sometimes, you know, spiritual insight, and I'm not trying to make a spiritual allegory here, but a lot of the times, spiritual growth doesn't come through sunshine and daisies. It comes through storms. And it certainly comes for them through a physical storm in this manner. So, Jesus has not forgotten about his chosen ones. He hasn't abandoned them. Let's read the rest of verse 48. "And about the fourth watch of the night, he cometh unto them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them." Sorry about that. So, Jesus sees them omnisciently, and he decides that he's going to test them. Now, I've wrestled with this phrase quite a bit, the phrase, "would have passed by them." And I believe that I've come to a sensible conclusion as to what it means. And it's not a good translation, but it's awkward to translate in the first place anyway. The literal word-for-word translation helps convey the meaning a little bit, I think. Basically, what it literally means is desired to come alongside of, okay? That's pretty much what it means, desired to come alongside of. It's an awkward translation, and almost all translations say would have passed by them, and as to why, I'm not exactly sure why, but the literal translation is desired to come alongside of. The Greek word we derive to pass by is paralethian, which means to come alongside of. So I'm going to go ahead and read the NASB with the knowledge that it means to come alongside of, which means to approach or, like I said, to come alongside. So it says, and he intended to pass by them, or that is, and he intended to come alongside of. So what that means is that Jesus sets his course, and you could probably even say that he changed his course a little bit, to come deliberately alongside of the disciples in the boat. He deliberately did that. And it says that, of course, he came walking to them by the sea, right? And that shouldn't be overlooked at all. It conveys unhindered movement. You have to think, this is a large body of water, and it's currently undergoing extreme storm conditions, right? The waves are not puny. This is the Sea of Galilee. So, you know, do I need to remind you that the disciples are straining to stay alive? Yet here comes Jesus for a late night stroll on the sea, and he's just casually defying the laws of gravity like they don't exist, and he's walking on water as if it's solid ground. So, what did the disciples do? We have the next verse. But when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit and cried out. Again, I think the English downplays what's happening here. Basically, these are 12 grown men screaming at the top of their lungs. That's what's happening. It's actually about like children screaming that like the boogeyman's in their room, except for it's grown men in a boat in the middle of the sea. That's kind of what's happening. The word ghost there comes from a Greek word that we called phantasma, which we get phantom or spirit ghost kind of thing from. Now, they thought this was a spirit treading on the water, and I guess they thought it was haunting them. There were tales back then of spirits haunting people on the sea. They had to come from somewhere. They're not new. They existed back then, too. Maybe they thought it was an urban legend that had come true or something, but you know, I doubt these men had ever given much thought to those stories, but in this moment, they seem to think that they're being haunted by something. So, that was the wrong response, though, and it was a sad response. What they should have immediately recognized to be Jesus, they thought was some sort of random spirit. The men are terrified. They have no clue what to do. And you're going to see this manifested in a moment, but a word that we see in a minute, it means that they were out of their minds. They were just they were at wit's ends. They were out of their minds. They were terrified. They were shaking. And they're fatigued and exhausted on top of that. They probably think they're about to meet their maker, but the sad thing is they didn't realize they were staring right at him. So, in response, Jesus says in this next verse, verse 50, for they all saw him and were troubled, and immediately he talked with them and saith unto them, be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. Now, literally translated, Jesus says, take courage, and I like that. He tells them to be brave and to stop fearing. Stop screaming like little children. Be brave. There's no reason to fear. And it's a courage that comes from God. He says, take courage. And they needed it. And then he says something that I really love. He said, it is I, but literally translated, that actually means I am. It means I am. And right here we see an echo of the Old Testament, right? We see, like, recall when Moses was talking to God at the burning bush, and he says, you know, who should I tell them that you are? And God says, I am. This is what Jesus is referencing. Jesus says, or God says, I am who I am. And Jesus says, I am who I am, essentially. And, you know, Jesus is standing on water. He's defying gravity. And he makes a giant allusion to God's covenant name. And it brings to mind actually one of my favorite verses in the Old Testament. And it's so easy to miss, especially if you hate poetry. And you don't have to turn to it. But in Job 9:8, Job is talking about God and all of his magnificence. And he says, God, who alone spreadeth out the heavens and treadeth upon the waves of the sea. I mean, I think of Psalm 77 and Isaiah 43 that talk about God making paths in the water and just treading on it, stampeding the waves. There's plenty of other instances, but the point here is that God alone walks on water. God walks on water. If you try to walk on water, you're going to get drenched really fast because that's how gravity and liquid work. But what if you had control of gravity? What if you invented it? What if you created the water, the waves, everything? Then you could tread on the waves. Then you could walk on the water. You can't stand on liquid. It's not going to work. You're human. But what if Jesus was more than human? You know, let no one ever say that the synoptic gospels never show the deity of Christ, because the last time I checked, only God could walk on water. So, you might have noticed at this point that we've only actually got two verses left in Mark, and I said that you wouldn't get out by 12:45, so don't worry, we're going to go to Matthew. No, joking. If you remember this story and all the different gospel accounts, you'll notice that Peter's absent. Remember, Jesus wasn't the only one that walked on the water this night. Peter did too. Turn to Matthew, Matthew 14:28, and as Dad has mentioned before, it's not our goal to teach you the harmony of the Gospels necessarily, but I believe that showing you what Peter does in this instance will benefit the passage in Mark quite a bit. And you might say, well, why isn't it mentioned in Mark? And my most honest answer is, I have no idea, because I'm not the Holy Spirit. I don't know. But I think whatever the reason, it has to do with the fact that Mark's gospel was based off of Peter's memoirs. So some have posited that Peter, maybe because he was being humble, didn't want to bring attention to himself. He didn't seem to mind doing that in the later chapters. Maybe he was embarrassed because, as we know, he doesn't quite pass that test. He starts to sink. But whatever the case, we just got to accept the fact that the Spirit didn't inspire Peter to put it in Mark, and he inspired it to put it in Matthew. So it's not in John either, by the way. All that matters is that it's in Matthew. So like I said, head over to Matthew, Matthew 14:28. Now, I want to read, that verse 28. And Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it be thou, bid me come unto thee on the water. Well, okay. I mean, just think about how silly that kind of is in a way. Peter, he's either so terrified that he just doesn't even know what to say and he just blurted out the first thing that came to his mind, or B, he's a really brave guy. I think it's the first one. These men are out of their wits. Remember, like I said, they just scream. Their adrenaline is running high. So Peter, in this moment, in this emotional turmoil, says, Lord, if that's you, tell me to get down there on the water. I don't know. What was he thinking? And it's kind of interesting the way that he says it. He says, Lord, command me. And here it says, what does it say? I'm sorry. It says, bid me come. That means command me. It kind of maybe shows a sliver of faith from Peter. He seems to think that somewhere in the confusion, he says, well, I mean, I'm probably going to die in this boat, so I guess it's better to be with Jesus out in the middle of the water. So I'm going to ask him to make me go over there. And I think that maybe we could say there was some faith shown here on Peter's part. I think it was being terrified mostly, but maybe there was some faith there. Maybe some. All that aside, Peter says this, and then we have our next verse, Matthew 29. And he said, come. And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Peter's been fishing in that sea his whole life. And every time he stuck his foot in that water, it went through the water, because that's how water works. That's how gravity works. And he probably stumbled about getting out of the boat. He's probably clambering on it. He probably did that a couple times. And then he just gets out of the boat and he starts walking over to Jesus. It's pretty bold. But for a moment, taking a break from looking at Peter, it's kind of interesting, actually, when you think about it, because it's one thing to walk on water. I mean, I guess that's pretty impressive if you can walk on water. But what if you could give someone the power to walk on water, too? What if you could give that power to someone else? That's something surely only God can do, right? I mean, Jesus gives Peter the power to walk on water. And are you beginning to see how tonight might be the night that they start to understand Jesus is a little bit more than a guy? He's a little bit more than just a man from God. Because not only can he walk on water, not only can he just snap his fingers and calm a storm, but he can make other people walk on water when he so desires. So, coming back to Peter, you see, he gets out of the boat, he's walking on the water, he goes up to Christ, then the wind starts picking up, right? And we have our next verse in Matthew, verse 30. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, saying, "Lord, save me. Lord, save me." And, you know, reality sets in for Peter. I guess he must have realized, oh, hey, I'm walking on water. There's a giant storm everywhere. And, you know, I'll cut him some slack. I probably would, you know, it would have jarred me too. And there's a good chance it would have jarred you too. So don't ever look at Peter with condescending eyes, because we all probably would have done the same thing. But he begins to doubt, right? He begins to doubt. He begins to become afraid, and he starts to see the storm. He starts to see the wind, and he's like, oh, no, I'm walking on water. And he becomes focused on all that instead of the one that was making him walk. He started to lose focus of the one that could calm the storm with the snap of his fingers. And his eyes start flitting back and forth, and he's seeing all this stuff. His breathing probably became hyperventilation, and any previous faith that he might have had has now fled, right? He's sinking, and he's doubting the only true solid ground that ever was. And in desperation, he cries out, "Lord, save me. Lord, save me." And, you know, I truly don't think the context here allows me to go on some sort of tangent about trusting God during storms of life and everything, but I believe there is merit here to examining kind of the nature of human beings. Peter just had to keep looking at Jesus. That's all he had to do. He just had to stay focused on Jesus. But the wind grew a little bit. He faltered, and his faith collapsed into eventual desperation and a cry out for help, just like that. And I think Jesus sums up what I'm trying to get at here in this next verse. In verse 31, "And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him, and said unto him, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" That is, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? And how fast we all are to just sink into the water sometimes. I mean, like I said, don't ever look at Peter with condescending eyes, because that would be about 99% of us right there. Us of little faith. Peter realized at this moment, if he hadn't already, that it was Jesus that was giving him the power to walk on water. And his heart was hardened by fear and doubt. Your heart can be hardened by other things besides disobedience. It can be hardened by fear. It can be hardened by doubt, which in a way is disobedience. But he began to sink, and he cries out, and God stretched out his arm, caught Peter, and then he said, "You have little faith. Why did you doubt? Why did you doubt?" And what does that even imply? What does that mean? It means you could have kept coming. I wasn't going to let you down. I have control over the storm. You have little faith. Why did you doubt? Why did you doubt? And isn't that just how we are all too often? Why did we doubt? Why do we doubt? The general principle of just not trusting God when he's the one in control of everything. And how often is it that once we do fail or sink, God stretches out his hand and catches us, and then he just says, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Why did you doubt?" And like I said, heart hardening can come from other things besides just disobedience and sin actions. It can come from fear and doubt. Their hearts were hardened. But right here, as Jesus and Peter are there standing on the water, as Peter is sinking into the water, and he cries out, "Lord, save me," and Jesus stretches out his arm and catches him, I believe Peter's heart and the others were melted right there. So, hold your place here. We're going to come back to this. Go back to Mark. Mark chapter 6, verses 51 and 52. I guess I should have held my place there. That would be good. I want to read verses 51 and 52. And he went up unto them in the ship, and the wind ceased. And they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure and wondered, for they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. Now, they were utterly astonished at what had just happened, because they hadn't gained any insight from the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus had come to them, walking on water, and given Peter to walk on the water, saved Peter from the storm, and then caused the storm to immediately cease. They were, as the literal rending reads, out of their wits. That's what it means. They were astonished. They were out of their wits. But they shouldn't have been astonished. That's the thing. They shouldn't have been. Because they should have known by now that Jesus is God. They should have known that. But they didn't gain any insight from the feeding. So they were astonished. They were out of their minds. However, even though Mark kind of ends this block of text here, there's actually a little bit of a happier ending to the story, because turn back to Matthew. I want to read the last couple verses there in Matthew 32 and 33. And when they were come into the ship, that is Jesus and Peter, the wind ceased. Then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, of a truth, thou art the Son of God. They worshipped him and they called him the Son of God. And Jesus did it. Despite all doubts, despite all the turmoil, Jesus gets it through to their heads. And they worship him. And this is why I said this is the night that they finally understand that Jesus is the Son of God. You know, Mark seems to record their astonishment more than anything, which is still useful because it shows us where they were spiritually. It shows us why this had to happen. But according to Matthew, this event finally clicks. It clicks in their head. How could it be anyone else besides the Son of God? How could it be anyone else besides God? Even prophets didn't do this stuff. The closest thing I can think of is Moses splitting the Red Sea, but that didn't mean Moses walked on the water. That means that they walked on dry ground, because Moses was still just a man. If Moses tried that, he would have drowned. Magicians can't replicate. No, there's the only thing here, the only possibility is that this is God. And the disciples realize it. They realize it. And then they do something either perfectly okay or extremely blasphemous. They start worshiping Jesus. And they're not, you know, they know the basic Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. They're either worshiping an idol or they're worshiping God, one of the two. They know what they're doing. And they finally see that Jesus is God. So we have this, and then we have our last verses back in Mark. We have verses 53 through 56, kind of a little ending cat to our text here. It says, and when they had passed over, they came into the land of Gennesaret and drew to the shore. And when they were come out of the ship, straightway they knew him and ran through the whole region round about and began to carry about in beds those that were sick where they heard he was. And whithersoever he entered, into villages or cities or country, they laid the sick in the streets and besought him that they might touch if it were but the border of his garment, and as many as touched him were made whole. We have this wonderful and gracious little block of text here, and I just think it's great because, you know, that Jesus and the disciples, they stop in Gennesaret. This has just happened. The disciples now realize that he is the Son of God. And Jesus just heals people everywhere, bestowing what I guess we would call common grace on people, because it's common to people at that point. And don't you know, it's interesting. People seem to realize that touching the hem of Jesus' garment will heal them. The good chance our woman with the issue of blood was a trend starter. Remember her? If I could just touch the hem of his garment. Yeah. So, you know, soon Jesus' popularity is going to start declining and the miracles and the signs are going to go away. But here, we just see God's grace manifested so nicely here, so sweetly here. And, you know, I once heard someone mention that when you look at most of Jesus' miracles, they were healing ones, most of them. And, you know, he could have showed his deity other ways. I mean, he obviously can. He walked on the water, for instance. But he could have called asteroids down to earth, or he could have called an angelic army, or he could have called down fire and brimstone. But instead, no, he healed people. And in a way, perhaps it's a picture of the purpose of which he came the first time, to heal spiritually sick, to heal the ones who need physician, a physician that can heal the spirit, the soul. And, of course, only God can do that. And there will come a day when, you know, he does call fire. There will come a day where he does call down fire, brimstone. He might destroy things, and, well, we know he's going to destroy things, and he's going to come with an angelic army to conquer the evil in the world. And the healing at that time will be over. It'll be completely over. But for now, that spiritual healing, that the physical healing here in, for instance, Gennesaret, that was just a picture of the spiritual healing that Jesus was there for, right? You know, the reason he sent the multitude away was because he was concerned with spiritual healing, spiritual feeding, and they didn't want that. They just wanted the physical aspect. But Jesus wasn't here to feed people. He wasn't here to just be a doctor. He was here to be a doctor to the soul. And, you know, if you don't have that doctor, if you don't have that healer, then I urge you to repent. And I urge you to ask Christ for it. Because all have sinned against God. And all are spiritually sick. And we are born a spiritual creature the moment we're born. We know this. And it's a curse. It's really a curse. And the good news is that there's a way to be healed of it. There's a way to be healed of it. And it's by putting faith in the God-man, who not only did things such as healing and walking on water and feeding people with bread out of nowhere, but he also did something even more miraculous. He bore the wrath of God on the cross for sinners. He died and then he rose again. You can trust in this Jesus. He walked on the water and saved those disciples so they would record it, put it down, and then spread the news and the story of him walking on the water, because it's true. And they would share that he is more than just a man. He's the Son of God. So, we saw the lengths that he went to in order to keep him. We saw that. We saw how manifested his deity was. We saw how clear that was. It's recorded in three Gospels, two of which are eyewitness accounts, one of which was an interview with the person that walked on water with him, which is Mark, and Peter and Mark. We saw the folly of human faith and how quickly we are to shatter. And then we saw how Jesus can overcome our spiritual dumbness and blindness and show indeed that he's the Son of God, one who can tread on the waves as if it's solid ground. And how? Because he's God. In the beginning of the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, right? So I pray that what you've gained from this most of all is that you see Jesus' deity more clearly. I hope that you can see how integral this passage is to the future disciples of the kingdom. You know, the night that Jesus walked on the water was the night that they understood this is the Son of God. And I'm thankful that he walked on the water, but because of that, through their witness, the disciples' witness, we have the Gospels, and I know now that he's the Son of God, and so do you. I pray that if anyone doesn't, they would read this account and understand that he is the Son of God. So we'll go ahead and end there. I don't know what to do now.